open discussion. We had some very nice talks today, very beautiful reviews, and I'm sure there are some pending questions from the morning session. So let me first ask the audience in the room, are there any questions you wanted to ask the speakers of today morning? Yes?
Yeah, this is for Abai. It was really a beautiful review.
Hi, Kasia.
Hi. Do you hear us, Sumati?
I can't hear anything from the panel.
Oh, thank you. I also don't hear anything. At least it's not just me.
That's not good. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yes, all right. All right. Now. Okay. Great. Thank you, Sumati. Yes, that would be a very one-sided discussion.
Oh, I was saying, you gave a very nice overview this morning. Some things to some of us, including me, that I don't follow very closely are well known of what you said this morning. There are results from several years back. I'm not sure instead if I got it right. Is the claim that the Hamiltonian constraint is solved is it a unique? Can you tell us, I mean, at least me, I would be very curious to hear a bit more about what these recent developments mean in relation to solving the Hamiltonian constraint. Is it a completely satisfactory solution? Is it unique? Do you have any idea that it's unique? Are there other paths? Could there be other definitions? So it was a very fast for me, the part on the Hamiltonian constraint. And of course, because I followed the previous development, I followed easily the other parts. But that part was really too fast for me.
So in case people didn't hear it, the question was about the Hamiltonian constraint and you know, what the status is, what we know about it. Okay, so the question can be asked at two different levels. One is full LQG, and that is your main interest, I think. And full loop quantum gravity, the Hamiltonian constraint. Now, there is actually a precise definition of this operator, which is very well controlled. And what is more interesting is the answer to the following question. If I look at the classical theory, then if I look at the Poisson bracket of constraints, and the reason why this is important is because the dynamics is essentially generated by the constraints, and therefore that Poisson algebra is important. Then what one finds is that the Poisson bracket between two Hamiltonian constraints is again constraints closed. That's why it's first class system. But what you have is structure functions and not structure constants. So it's not a true Lie algebra. And therefore the question is, how do you promote this when you promoted Hamiltonian constraint to quantum theory by an operator and so on? What happens to this algebra? And in particular, are there anomalies? Is there a consistent framework or not? So let me just tell you the current version instead of telling you the historically what happened. So current version is that this Madhavan Varadarajan has a series of papers with some co-authors, but most of it is himself, in which he has given a precise meaning to this Hamiltonian constraint, which is completely well defined on the Hilbert spaces that I was talking about and so on, and such that the commutator between the two Hamiltonian constraints, the right-hand side, is precisely the diffeomorphism constraint as in the classical theory. And so it's not only that it is consistent, but it is in fact faithfully mimicking what happened in the classical theory there. And so this is kind of the main result. Now the question is about solving this Hamiltonian constraint. Well, of course, there are infinitely many solutions to this Hamiltonian constraint. Formally, one can write down the anansas to solve them, etc. But at the moment, I mean, one doesn't learn anything very deep about from actual solutions. What one has is really the result of consistency, that there is a consistent framework.
For example, every operator eigenstates on the kinematical Hilbert space, are they going to be, can one answer at least this question? With this description of the Hamiltonian constraint, are those states still, are they on the physical Hilbert space? Because, you know, they are clearly on the kinematical Hilbert space, but they might not be on the physical Hilbert space. Now you have a tool to characterize the physical hyperspace, are those area eigenstates still, I mean, are they in the physical hyperspace?
Very good. So, for example, if I looked at the area operator, it's really quantum Riemannian geometry, the way it's first introduced, right? So what you have is really, you give, so it's a, to begin with, is a kinematical construction. In other words, just like in general relativity, right? You can just, you can start with differential geometry and manifold, you can write down some region, and you have, there's a differential geometry will assign it some volume or a surface, and it will assign to it some area. And if you change the metric, this changes, and therefore, this is a function on the space, on the phase spacer. But of course, this is just the full phase space. The, as you say, the solution of the Hamiltonian constraint and so on are going to be solving the constraints. And so, in particular, there will be diffeomorphism invariant things. So therefore, there will be diffeomorphism invariants imposed. And therefore, what we have to do is to specify the surface on which you want to calculate the area in a diffeomorphism invariant way. Otherwise, it's not an observable for the, on the physical sector. So for example, if you had matter, then you could define it as surface of discontinuity. For example, here there is no matter, here there is matter. And I can ask for what the area of this surface is. Under diffeomorphism, the matter is also moved and the metric is also moved, but the area of the surface will remain the same. So you have to ask the question not about area operator, but you have to ask the question about area operator. You have to phrase the question in an invariant manner, that area operator of some invariantly specified surface. And that would have discrete eigenvalues. And one example is always, you know, given often is, you know, the horizon of a black hole that is isolated by imposing certain horizon boundary conditions, which are operator boundary conditions of the state, and you can calculate the area in that case. So you have to ask the question in a physical way, that is to say, in a way that is that respects the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory.
Okay, we have a comment here or question.
I have a question. If I had a question to Sumati. In this causal...
Sumati, can you hear the question? Okay.
Yes. Great. Thank you.
Yes,
so
ahead.
Where does the dimensionality of space appear in your approach?
Right. So one place where it does appear in this sort of standard way of writing the partition function is in the choice of action. So I can pick the action to be two-dimensional or four-dimensional. That's where it. That's where we make a choice. In general, like the first part of my talk about the full partition function on omega n, the analytic calculation, that omega n contains all possible causal sets of size n, which include, for n large enough, they include any possible dimensional space time that you can imagine. So anything that's, you know, that's allows for, you know, for n very, very large, you'll have all possible spacetimes with a whole range of dimensions. And that's the space in which we work. So there's no dimension kinematically that we put in into that calculation. And so getting out dimension, spacetime dimension, I think someone mentioned it in the last session, that is in fact something that we want to come out of the theory. What is the, even though we don't put it in, except possibly in the action. So on the other hand, the state sum models or the Lorentzian statistical geometry models are ones in which, you know, because computationally things are quite hard to do in omega n, that's the space of all possible causal sets of size n, we do a dimensional restriction. But even then, that dimensional restriction is does not order theoretically, you know, remove things that aren't, I mean, in other words, you're not just looking at things that look like spacetimes or continuum, you also include things that are very quantum in their structure, but there's sort of an order theoretic dimension which you impose to simplify the calculation. But ideally, the idea would be that space-time dimension emerges from the theory.
Right, so that's actually similar to the goal in string theory, where in string theory you also want... in string theory, the goal is also that our 3+1 dimensional world will emerge dynamically from something which has a different number of space-time dimensions. And there, mathematical consistency picks the number of space-time dimensions. So can you imagine that there's a similar dynamical attractor mechanism that basically says that the three dimensions which emerge as large will, that there are only three spatial dimensions that emerge as large?
Right. So, I mean, we don't have some consistent dynamical model yet, but I think that it's a very reasonable thing to expect that even a Kaluza-Klein kind of compactification of some sort could be something that is in the continuum approximation of the theory. But at the very deepest level, one doesn't necessarily expect anything like a continuum, and therefore not anything necessarily like a continuum dimension. So it's only in some coarse-grained level that you expect that anything like space-time dimension in the sense of a continuum space-time dimension could emerge. So typically you would imagine that in the deepest quantum regime, in the deepest quantum regime that you possibly would have fractal dimensions, but that in some emergent level you'd get out the right dimensions.
Can I follow
up? Yeah, Abhay, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, isn't there a difference between what Robert was saying about string theory and you? Namely, in string theory, one can start with some fundamental 10-dimensional theory, and then there are some solutions so Robert is disagreeing with it. Okay, so let me not talk about Robert. So just talk about the causal sense up here. So in your case, I mean, it's really the action that knows about the dimension, right? I mean, in other words, if you start out with the four-dimensional action, then the hope would be that there will be some semi-classical configurations which would be four-dimensional in that case. If you started with a two-dimensional action, then there will be some semi-classical configurations. That's right, right? You're saying yes. Okay.
Right. So yes. So definitely that if the action has a certain dimension in the models that I presented, in the sort of partition function that I presented, if you put in the action of a certain dimension, in fact, one of our results, we think this is true, we haven't yet fully proven it, is that if you look at the contribution from the wrong dimension, say for flat space or the wrong dimension, so you put in flat space of six dimensions, but your action is four-dimensional, then it suggests that essentially the contribution from the six dimensions is in the large n limit is actually negligible. Exactly. So, it's highly oscillatory in the path integral. It doesn't really contribute in some average sense. I think, yeah, so there are differences with string theory in the sense that we're not requiring that there be a fundamental dimension which is then consistent. In fact, the idea would be that at a fundamental level, there is something that's really not like space-time, and it's only in a coarse-grained sense that what you get out. So you could have structure that looks very different from continuum space-time on the small, but then when you, in the sense of effective theories, you integrate out that small fluctuation, then you get, on an average, you get things that look like the continuum. And so then space-time dimension emerges, continuum space-time dimension emerges. And in the cases that I showed, we hope that it'll come out just by putting in the right dimension of the action. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we have some questions online. So can maybe somebody read them or?
Yes, so there are two questions online and one anonymous. So let's start with the questions online. Francisco Bento Lustosa asks to Abhay, how the measure problem can be dealt in loop quantum gravity. How can we define probability distributions for quantum cosmology without imposing some type of Born rule? How can one derive such a rule in the context of loop quantum gravity?
Did you hear it? I can't hear it.
So it was about measurement in loop quantum gravity and in particular in loop quantum cosmology, I guess.
Yes.
And how do you impose something like a Born rule?
Okay. So I think that so far, most people working in loop quantum gravity have taken conventional attitude about, say, imposing a Born rule or whatever, which is really you've got a Hilbert space, and then there is a norm on the Hilbert space, and that norm is used to give the Born rule. In cosmological context, I think the most satisfactory answer would be in terms of consistent histories approach that was developed by Hartl and Gell-Mann and other people, and then applied to loop quantum cosmology by several people, including Param Singh. And there again, one asks a question such as, is it given a certain quantum state, or given all possible quantum states, is the bounce happening with what probability is it happening? So it's really a consistent history picture that one is using, and then one is answering the questions that probability is essentially one in this case. And if you take Wheeler-DeWitt theory, they find that the probability is essentially zero. And so it's really consistent history picture that is used in cosmological context. But in the case of black holes and such things, there is often effective geometry inside, and then one is using just the Born rule using the Hilbert space in a product on the quantum states that we do have.
Okay, and there is another question for you that is anonymous. How quantum information play a role in loop quantum gravity? Quantum information.
So that's again quantum information. Okay.
So how does what?
How quantum information plays a role in loop quantum gravity? Sorry, it's not so easy to understand exactly.
Yeah, it's funny because this echo depends really on the line between here and there.
Can you hear me better if I place this closer?
There's a bit of an echo, so.
No, that's fine. Okay.
But it's okay.
I think that I only done one work on this. The best people are really Eugenio Bianchi and Ezra Levine. And that work has to do with entanglement, basically. And this entanglement is done using spin net networks and spin nodes. If you like, usually one has this qubit systems, and one discusses entanglement about it. You've got n qubits. But that is now replaced by spin networks, and one asks very similar questions as in quantum information theory. So I really refer to them. They have a very nice review, which is 2023, so this year review. And the authors are Eugenio Bianchi and Ezra Levine.
So there is a question or comment from Miguel.
Yeah, it's a question for Pedro. So in the conformal bootstrap, very often you have bounds and you have theories living at the bounds, exactly at the corners of the bounds, and by assuming that you are saturating the bounds at some corner, you can often find extra information about the CFT. Like the things that you typically optimize over, you can say what they are at the extremal point. Is this something that you could do in this approach? And can you use it to learn stuff, for instance, if you assume the string theory lies saturation? Or...
Yeah, so since we are solving an optimization problem, and the variables are the variables that appear in the amplitude, for any amplitude that is at the boundary, once we finish the optimization problem, we can now plot the amplitude, and we can look how the amplitude looks like. And we don't need to just stick with alpha. We can look at that amplitude and ask, are there resonances? What's the energy behavior? We can ask lots of interesting questions about it. In this example, it was just a one-dimensional boundary because we were just minimizing alpha. Sometimes in S-matrix bootstrap, we consider more than one-dimensional space, and then we have lines or surfaces along which we can indeed look at the amplitudes. and for example, in pions compared with experiments. And in this particular case, all we can do is look for the resonances and try to see if they would have some explanation in string theory.
And have you looked at them? Do they have like a string? Because it's a string theory, but a strong coupling, so it could be different,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so we know very little about what we expect. So for example, for these amplitudes that seem to have the extremal alpha, we find some curved Reggie trajectory. So instead of a linear Reggie trajectory, as we have in perturbative string theory, we get one which is curved with some power 3/2 or 3/4, I forgot. And but we don't know. I mean, should I think of this curved Reggie trajectory as a deformation of the linear one as we increase the coupling, or are these new states? I don't have a good intuition for what to expect. Let me just make one obvious comment, which is CFTs are often isolated points, and quantum field gapped quantum field theories, no. Because you can always add garbage in the UV.
Thanks.
So are there any more online or anonymous questions? So maybe I will take that and then go back to the
room. Can you hear me if I place this closer? Is this fine? Okay. So there is one more question by Ivano Basile to Pedro. Asymptotically safe gravity should reproduce scattering amplitudes that approach a constant at high energies, perhaps in a suitable kinematic regime, because of quantum scale invariance. Can this possibility for UB behavior be investigated with S-matrix bootstrap methods?
So the quantities I was studying were the low energy parameters, right? So it was, what's the first deviation we would see from gravity as we start increasing the energy? And as such, typically, high energy is very unwieldy. It's like a zero mode. Because many things can happen at high energy that will not have such a huge effect on the most low energy parameter of the theory. So for most problems, imposing the behavior at high energy has no effect at low energy, and that probably is the case if you just impose that the amplitude goes to a constant or grows with a power, probably it will have no effect for this particular bounce. But if you want to identify a particular theory, instead of a space of theories, we have to try to figure out what extra property should I impose, what extra physical principle should I impose that would be true for asymptotic gravity and would not be true for another UV completion. If we have this property, we can impose it. Otherwise, it will be hard to single out.
And there was a question.
For Pedro. So how do you learn from this shape, from the shape of the region that you found? So was it something expected? You could estimate that you were all trying to argue what happened at infinity or this kind of things. So the way that you did the drawing was for a particular type 2B in 10 dimensions, I think.
Yeah.
And was that predictable? I mean, the shape of the region that was going to be like that and asymptotic to infinity. And what, do you have a guess what will be for more, less supersymmetry and less dimensions?
So what was the key prop? So first, I did not reproduce that figure from the bootstrap. I only studied a one-dimensional projection, and I just minimized alpha and saw that the minimum of alpha seems to be close to the minimum of that 2D figure. I would need to do a numerical study of alpha and beta to start carving out a two-dimensional surface. If I did it, I would not find that shape. That we know for sure. And the reason is that this problem is convex. So I would, at most, the closest thing I could have to that shape is what's called the convex hull of that shape. So you could, and the convex hull will approach that shape on the left, if you remember there was some, but on the right, there will be a big space that for sure will be there. Because the space, whatever space we will find, it will be a convex space. And that space was not convex. It has some beautiful shape. Now, if we get some space that is the convex hull of what I'm getting there, that would kind of indicate that it looks like string theory is very special because it's all we can get. Now, what else is crucial about that space is that there is a region where the parameters are very big, and that is the regime of perturbative string theory. Because in perturbative string theory, string effects show up much earlier than the Planck scale. They show up at the string length scale. And that's a big advantage. That's good because we know a lot about perturbative string theory up there, and we know very little about the regime down here. So that's a big advantage of doing this two-dimensional study, which is I could say I fix alpha to be very big, and then I minimize, maximize beta. But now, because I fix alpha to be very big, I'm in the perturbative regime. So these various sections of alpha would allow me now to tune how is the string length and the Planck length, what is the relation between them. And it allow me to interpolate between perturbative string theory and strongly coupled string theory. Then I could ask this question that I was saying before. I have this curved Reggie trajectory. Is it the continuation of the various massive states of string theory, or are these new states that enter? Because I would be able to follow it continuously.
Any more questions in the room? You have a question.
I actually have a question. It's for Sumati. So it's about the first sort of Hess transition that you find in these simulations. And as far as I remember, you said that it's only two-dimensional simulations. So do you have any estimates what happens to the order or to the strength of the first order transition if you go to three dimensions? You said, and as a follow-up also, you mentioned four dimensions is computationally very difficult. So how, like, what is the computational expense scaling with dimensionality?
Right. So the last question I don't have an immediate answer to, which is I don't know how expensive it's going to be. But let me just get back to so a lot of work has been done in the two-dimensional model, just because in two dimensions, a particular class of, you know, loosely speaking, things that embed into the causal diamond, causally embed into it, are mathematically, they're called 2D orders, and they're easy to deal with. And so this system has been studied very, very extensively. But we do have simulations in the case of a cylinder, so two-dimensional S1 cross R, as well as the case of T2 cross R. So in both cases, so the 2D cases as well as in the 3D cases, there is a first order phase transition. And you go from a continuum phase to one that is highly layered. It looks very similar to the kind of KR posets that are, you know, the layered posets, but they have a very different connectivity structure. And this seems to be ubiquitous. I frankly would be very surprised if in four dimensions we see something very different, but so far we haven't actually tackled the four-dimensional case, just because it means that you have to go to much larger n. And the problem is that, I mean, maybe roughly the scaling is goes to some fairly horrible power of n, because what you have to do in a Monte Carlo simulation is every time you update, you have to recalculate the action for the entire causal set because of non-locality. You can't piece it together and say, I'm just changing this little bit, this little local bit, and then I update the action. You have to change it through the entire causal set, calculate the entire action every single time. That's a very expensive move. And although there have been some really good improvements in the code, which we used in the S1 cross R as well as the T2 cross R case, I should say I, because they're finite in time, those, you know, only get you so far. But if you want to go to four dimensions, you really need a lot more elements in your causal set for it to become meaningful, for you to be able to look at do scaling arguments and so on, finite size scaling. So maybe it's just a matter of lots and lots and lots of cores, but I think it would be nice to do something more efficient.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, just maybe to wrap this up, if there are no more urgent questions, we have heard from the three of you very different approaches to quantum gravity, which, I mean, on the face of it, look like totally different. So what I would like you to do is maybe comment what have you learned from the other approaches, and preferably, well, one of the approaches discussed today, but also anything else at the conference, and where do you see intersections for people who are maybe not so familiar with the big picture? And I will start it sort of chronologically, so maybe Abhay can go first. You got the hard one.
I think that in instinct theory, there have been extremely interesting mathematical results. But I mean, to me, it's a little bit unclear as to what the relevance is for kind of the world that we live in. As today, somebody was pointing out in the panel, I think, that it's four-dimensional. There's cosmological constant is positive, or very small, so greater than or equal to zero. And we, so far, haven't seen supersymmetry and so on and so forth. On the other hand, I think that somehow there is something very deep and beautiful, which is really that there is a unifying principle, in, you know, potentially, to bring in all the interactions together. I mean, it was really inspired by this unification idea, as Carlo was saying on Monday. And I think that is missing in loop quantum gravity or in any other approach, namely constraining what kind of matter you would have, what kind of interactions between them that you have in some general way. And the viewpoint in loop quantum gravity has been a bit like what happened in general relativity. I mean, general relativity is a theory of gravity. It doesn't particularly tell you how, you know, that there are so many Young-Mills fields and so many electromagnetic fields and so on. It just says that, well, you give me the matter field and I will do this. And then it is left to the, you know, the real world to see which fields are relevant. If you have stars, and if you have perfect fluid, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it would be much nicer if we could learn something from, say, string theory about this world. The causal set theory, I think, the causal sets, for example, I mean, the fact that it is really uses the idea that there is no underlying space-time, that fundamentally the structure is really points, right? I mean, it's discrete, which just causal relation, is very attractive. But I'm not sure that I can take any concrete lesson from it that could be used, for example, in loop quantum gravity or other approaches, because I think it is still being developed quite a bit. I mean, there's been a lot of progress, but I think it is still in the sense of development. So, for example, I don't know what it has to do with, to say any about physical problems, either in particle physics or cosmology or, you know, and so, I mean, there is an issue that we heard about the, you know, cosmological constant problem. But I think that is also, I consider it to be at a more elementary stage. So I think it's a very fundamental approach, and it is something that, you know, postulates that only the causal relations are fundamental. And whether it's true or not, we don't know, but I think we need to have more results to have a concrete idea as to what direction it would be, one could take those ideas and incorporate them. So I don't have good intuition yet for this.
Thank you, Abhay. Sumati, so can you comment on loop quantum gravity and string theory?
So there are some points of commonality, and I think, so if I start with ideas in string theory, the fact that there's a fundamental degree of freedom and that space-time is emergent. Causal set theory is in some sense similar, that the continuum is emergent. But there's sort of that level of similarity, approximate similarity to that. On the other hand, there are very big differences, because one is, of course, not using necessarily field theoretic ideas as sort of the most fundamental, but more geometric ideas. And in that sense, this is also, I think, makes it closer to loop quantum gravity. Something Abhay said just now, which I think is very interesting in the loop quantum cosmology point of view, trying to use consistent histories, that's closer to the kind of history's approach and trying to give meaning to with it, without the use necessarily of external observers, give meaning to measures on space-time. So this again resonates with the kinds of things that we do. I didn't mention it in my talk today, but that's sort of also. Can I also talk about, I'd also like to talk about things that are common with other approaches that we've heard of so far.
Sure.
One, of course, is causal dynamical triangulations, which has a lot of similarities, in particular with things in the Monte Carlo simulations, although the non-locality puts causal sets in a slightly, in a very different, technically makes it very different from that or spin forms. And spin forms, again, coming from loop quantum gravity, is again, because it has this histories formulation, I think there's a lot of commonality. But coming away from these into the sort of more effective field theory approaches, things that Astrid talked about as well, I think there are many techniques there that I hope we can learn from in causal set theory, in particular, trying to see how to do renormalization group in the right way. And that was a reason for putting out those, you know, couple of slides on quantum fields on causal sets, that the effect of discreteness, there is a very specific effect of that causal set, the random discreteness, that puts a mark on the kind of, on the field theory that's sitting on this. And I think those techniques are trying to understand how non-locality, quantum causal set non-locality, how does it appear in effective field theories? I think those are actually really interesting questions, phenomenologically and just from the point of view of connecting to non-physics. So I think that's a very promising direction.
Thank you, Sumati. And finally, Pedro, would you like to comment on, all the approaches you think you have connections to?
Yeah, so I don't have any particular bias towards any approach. I think I'm open-minded, but maybe there are some topics that have been recently appearing within string theory or within string theory, people that work with string theory related to quantum information. I think those type of topics are topics that probably one could study with different approaches and could give you benchmarks of computing entanglement entropies in regions and trying to compare them, because these are the type of quantities that you can compute if you have some tensor network or if you have some graphs or if you have some whatever formulation you have. We know what it means to define a density matrix and to integrate over the rest and to compute things. So I think that is one point that people, say, in holography, try to think of ADS as a sequence of tensors and draw some tensors that could resemble space-time. That has some similarity. Sometimes it works more as a level of inspiration to see where information is. Sometimes it can be made a little bit precise, but it's not the most precise thing yet, and it could be the way to go or not. I'm not sure, but it's something that some people in string theory think about, this more information theoretical point of view. The discretization there, it's mostly based on inspiration from these tensor networks that people use in condensed matter to study critical systems. And of course, another common point to the many of the things we have heard would be, for example, the fact that we have matrix models and that string theory is often based on matrix models that, after all, emerged as the discretization of 2D gravity. And so, of course, there we do know how to continuum limits work, and we know that it does lead to continuum limits of 2D surfaces. And my understanding was that if you try to go beyond we start putting more indices to describe higher dimensional stuff, that it's very hard and that normally you don't get a continuum. And that was more or less why that original motivation for matrix models then went towards other interesting problems of statistical mechanics and so on, but not really gravity. But I thought it was very cute to see this action that would suppress this very degenerate space times with three layers, and that could potentially increase the number of layers. That was very cute. I mean, I think it would be very nice to see if something like this, if a new continuum limit appears, whether it's gravity or just a super awesome statistical mechanics model. In both cases, it's a win-win. That sounds very interesting.
Thank you. I think we are out of time, if I understand the organizers correctly. Okay, so it's time to thank our speakers again for this nice discussion.